AgriTalk is brought to you by Full Scale from Helena. Grow strong returns this season with breakthrough foliar nutrition from Full Scale at Reproduction. AgriTalk is sponsored by Coron Metro. When the time is right for nutrition, give your crops more than just nitrogen with Coron Metro, the next evolution in foliar fertilizers. We are headed for a potential record high today, and all that heat is expected to brew up some severe weather. And with the severe weather comes rain, and with the rain comes lower prices. But that is just one reason for price pressure. We will talk with a founder of the ethanol industry about how the uncertainty from EPA is also impacting price.
Live from the downslope of this week via Farm Journal broadcast, this is AgriTalk. This morning we begin with a conversation with Jeff Broin from Poet. Then it's Amy Wagner from Dairy Management, Inc. And later, Melissa Brandau from Herd Dog. Right after the news, Greg Henderson from Drovers. I'm handsome newsman Davis Michelson. Now, the host of AgriTalk, Jeff Larhey.
Yeah, Davis. Hey, man.
Hey, buddy.
Thank you so much.
Hey.
It is starting to warm up here in Northeast Iowa, and we are we've still got a ways to go before we get to the high that is going to be pretty oppressive by the time we get to, you know, late this afternoon, early this evening. The guys at BAMWX, mm-hmm. I wouldn't call it a warning. I would say that they are doing right now is raising awareness that there is the potential for some severe weather in southern Minnesota, eastern half of Iowa, I would call it, into Wisconsin, northern Illinois. So we need to be aware that in the overnight hours, and maybe not even the overnight hours. I mean, they're talking about like 9 to 2, you know, stuff like that for the potential for some severe weather in that general area. So
well,
we need
I
to
would
be
take
aware
the rain because I've got a full on Lion King effect going on my yard farm here.
Dude,
it's the circle of life. I've got some grass that's given up and is just dead and brown. Meanwhile, I have other varieties, I guess, of grass that's like fully headed right now, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know what to do. And so my impulsion is just to do nothing and not mow it. And until the neighbor mows, I'm in good shape.
See, I decided that I was going to make it rain by going ahead and mowing the lawn yesterday, thinking, we had a chance for some rain, and we did get some rain. It's as Bob Birdsall describes to us, you know, it's that 6-inch rain that we got overnight. Six inches between the drops. And that's basically all that we got.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
good morning.
Pretty tough.
Good morning, Bob.
We've got a conversation with Jeff Broin today.
Oh, dude.
We had the conversation yesterday. I know what's in it. You guys want to pay attention to this. It's a revealing conversation with Jeff. It's why he is as excited about the ethanol industry as he has ever been. And when you can increase the size of your company by 40% by signing your name at the bottom of the page, that's pretty impressive stuff. All right.
Yeah.
We got to get going. Let's get to the news.
Let's do. Well, Chip, the Federal Reserve is signaling a faster than expected pace of policy tightening. Yesterday's analysis suggested 2 rate hikes by the end of 2023, and Chair Jerome Powell said it was the, quote, talking about meeting in reference to the discussion on tapering. The action the bank did take yesterday was to raise by 5 basis points the rate on its overnight reverse repurchase agreement facility and the interest paid on excess reserves. In other economic news, U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen defended the Biden administration's $6 trillion budget proposal for fiscal 2022 before the Senate Finance Committee, saying ambitious fiscal policy would help counter racial inequality and climate change. There's nothing like nationally crippling debt to fix racial inequality and climate change. Chip, your thoughts?
That is not on Jerome Powell's resume. I will guarantee that.
Well, a heat wave across the western U.S. is expected to become more severe, raising the risk of wildfires and heat deaths in an area already experiencing drought conditions. Several states have issued excessive heat warnings, and roughly 200 million people will experience temperatures over 90 degrees Fahrenheit as the week goes on. Power grid officials of economic powerhouses California and Texas have asked residents to limit energy use to prevent outages. Prospects for a bipartisan infrastructure deal improved yesterday as 21 senators, including 11 Republicans, signed on to a bipartisan framework for a $579 billion package. Such legislation would still need support from nearly all 50 Democrats in the chamber unless more Republicans sign on. And it does include a funding mechanism that the White House has opposed, and that's indexing the national gasoline tax to inflation.
Not going to happen.
A group of House and Senate Democrats are calling on EPA to not take any actions to waive RFS requirements for some refiners, as some media reports have suggested. While expressing support for the administration's efforts on climate change, the lawmakers said in a letter to the EPA that they are, quote, concerned that rolling back the RFS obligation for refiners directly contradicts this work.
Yeah, it's like we've been talking about all week on AgriTalk. If they go forward with some of these changes and adjustments to the RFS, can you believe anything that the Biden administration is saying about their battle against climate change? And we don't forget, we got to watch the National Economic Council Director Brian Deese on this one. That's where the signal is going to come from.
U.S. regulators are poised to ban products from Huawei and four other Chinese electronics companies, including surveillance cameras widely used by American schools, but linked to oppression in Western China. And GM is accelerating its electric vehicle production targets. The auto giant said it would build two new U.S. battery plants, now plans to spend $35 billion on EVs by 2025. Chip.
Yeah, where are they going to get the stuff to make those batteries with? I still don't have the answer to that.
Preach.
I don't have the answer to that. All right, thank you, Davis. Let's bring in Greg Henderson, editorial director at Drovers. How you doing, Greg?
Good morning, Chip. I'm doing well. I'm ready for some of this heat to end, though. It's early in the season.
Yeah. Is that part of the reason that the cash cattle market finally decided to push up a bit this week?
You know, everything's been crazy in the cattle market this year. And in fact, it's higher this week for the first time in 7 weeks, Chip, and the highest price in 16 months. That's 123 to 124 price in Iowa. Yesterday in Texas, 122. So there's been some bullish spillover in the futures market. Live cattle made live contract highs yesterday. And all of that's good news. The bullish does not carry over to the wholesale beef prices, which are down $12 just this week, which is, you know, contra-seasonal anyway. So, you know, analysts are calling for prices to be higher this year. Not to go crazy. You know, we're not going to see 130, 135 fed cattle, but we are going to see smaller numbers from here on out. Should be supportive of prices. Demand seems to be holding well.
Yeah. That box beef market is down this week, but it's still like 335 or something like that. It's still crazy strong.
Exactly. So there's a lot of demand out there, and we're selling beef. But, you know, it's not going to last forever the way it is.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate that very much, buddy. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
All right. And he hit me with some breaking news earlier today. Wednesday, June 23rd, 2 p.m. EDT, there will be a Senate Ag Committee hearing examining markets, transparency, and prices from cattle producer to consumer. That's what Chuck Grassley told us was going to happen on Monday right here on AgriTalk.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Clarifly Larvicide, your feed-through fly control solution.
No doubt you've heard of MetLife, but did you know that MetLife Investment Management has over 100 years of ag lending experience? The MetLife Investment Management team maintains close relationships with its borrowers and can structure a customized loan with flexible terms to meet your financial needs. Looking to expand, refinance, or recapitalize? Consider MetLife Investment Management. Learn more at MetLife.com/ag.
AGI SureTrack's Bin Manager is the industry's leading grain bin management solution, supported by the only platform on the market to connect data points from across your operation. Soil, weather, machine, agronomic, equipment, and grain characteristic data combine to deliver a data story that drives profit and production. Mobile or desktop, stay informed, stay safe, and stay connected with AGI SureTrack. For more information, visit www.agisuretrack.com.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Indigo's Carbon Farming Connection, a free virtual event on June 23rd where industry-leading experts and farmers will discuss the state of agricultural carbon markets. Learn more at indigoag.com/carbonfarming.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory, and I'm thrilled to have this guest with us. We've got Jeff Broyne, founder of Poet, with us. Jeff, it's good to talk with you again. How are you?
I'm doing great. Good to talk with you, Chip.
Wow, you have been busy building up the Poet footprint out across the countryside. Tell us about it.
Just a few weeks ago, on June 1st, we completed the acquisition of Flint Hills ethanol assets. That's the Koch Brothers business ethanol assets. It was about 800 million gallons, six plants in two states, all large facilities. It allowed us to grow 40% overnight, putting us at about 3 billion gallons a year now. So if you'd have told me 30 years ago that we'd be 3 billion gallons someday, I wouldn't have believed you. So
Yeah, when you were having all those garage meetings across southern Minnesota, spreading the word about ethanol, I would imagine that you would be a little bit surprised. Jeff, the question that I get from producers all over the place is the Flint Hills move, was that Koch interested in selling or Poet more interested in buying?
They came to us first, so they came wanting to exit those assets, and we thought it was a good time to purchase them. So it worked out really well for both parties.
Excellent, excellent. Okay. Obviously, you've always been optimistic, excited about biofuels and their place in our fuel system. But I know that Poet, or I've been reading that Poet is very optimistic now about the other industrial uses for biofuels. Tell us about that and where that optimism comes from.
Well, we've made some recent investments in some industrial capacity at a couple of our facilities so that we can make cleaner, higher quality alcohols that can be used in everything from pharmaceuticals to hand sanitizers to even potable alcohol. So we think there's opportunity in that marketplace. We think that it can be done better than maybe some other folks are doing it. And so we are entering that market as well. It won't be a huge percentage of our capacity, but maybe, 2, 3, 4, 5% down the road of our capacity could possibly be some industrial products that go all over the world and be used in, ethanol in everything you can think of. It's in hairspray. It's in a lot of your women's cosmetics. It's in pharmaceuticals. I don't think people understand how many things it's in. Obviously, it's the vodka you drink on the weekend. It's used to make all the other alcohols that people drink. So, ethanol is really all over around us, and I'm not sure people really understand that. Also, you can use it in your car.
yes, we can. Absolutely. It's the push for a biodegradable, I'll go that far, alternative to many of the plastics out there that's got me interested. What's the opportunity there?
That's a tougher one. It's certainly something we've looked at, but perhaps a bit of a tougher one long term. It can be done through some different processes, fermentation processes that don't exactly make ethanol but make other products. And obviously there's some folks out there doing that. But that's not something we're working hard on at
okay.
Poet, but others are definitely working on that. We work more on asphalt additives, industrial grade alcohols,
yeah.
And of course we're still looking to the fuel market as well. There's still we're looking at this climate change challenge, and our president wants to take on climate change. Well, quite frankly, there's no really good way to solve climate change without agriculture. We have to return to the surface of the earth. You know, we have to use the corn leaves, which are the solar panel, the leaves of the plants that are solar panel. We have to use the seeds, which are the battery, which you can store indefinitely. You can't store solar energy. You know, you can use it, which is awesome. We're putting a solar farm here right now. But you can store the seeds that come from solar energy. And I think that the world perhaps hasn't figured out that agriculture is one of the biggest solutions to climate change.
Okay. One of the concerns that I'm picking up from producers out there right now, Jeff, is that is the rest of the world leaning a little too hard on agriculture to fix the climate, to be the climate solution that they all want? Is agriculture getting too much of the focus?
I think that, you know, some are out there saying agriculture is a problem in climate change and agriculture.
Yeah.
Actually, agriculture is a solution. So I think we need to turn that narrative around. But I think the agricultural potential of the world is virtually untapped. You look at continents like Africa, parts of Central and South America. There's so many areas of the world that are running at 20% of their ag capacity on the land they're already tilling, or 30 or 40, where there's huge potential to produce larger volumes of starch, cellulose, you know, obviously micronutrients, all the things we get from the plant. And I think that, you know, perhaps cellulose is yet underrated as a feedstock. We have to stop pulling oil out of the ground. You can't fix climate change without stopping to pull oil out of the ground. So you got to have that vision that 50 years from now or 70 years from now, someday we simply won't drill oil wells anymore.
Yeah.
And if you're not going to drill oil wells, where are you going to get that energy? It's got to come from the sun, the soil, and the seed. And all gifts from God, by the way, the sun, the soil, and the seed. And that's what it's going to return to, in my opinion. And will there be other technologies? Sure. But agriculture is going to be a huge part of the solution to climate change. And I don't know if the world's figured that out yet, but they're about to. I believe they're okay. About to.
Interesting. Okay. You mentioned it. President Biden has had a very much his narrative is very pointed at fighting the climate change battle. And then we continue to pick up some rumors that the renewable volume obligation might be lowered, that EPA is considering some waivers from the renewable fuel standard for small refiners. To me, those the want to battle climate change, along with doing anything to reduce ethanol in our fuel supply, are counterproductive. They're counterpoints to each other. It doesn't make any sense to me.
What you're seeing there is the political power of the oil industry, which we know far too well in this business. And they are leaning hard. You can't believe how hard and how many lobbyists they have working in D.C. right now to try to turn back, which they do under every administration, find a way to lie, cheat, and steal and turn back, right, against obviously there's a lot of money going into campaigns. You know all this works. But what we have to do here in rural America is we have to use our champions, our legislators, and we have to be pushing them hard to stand up to the oil lobbyists, to stand up to the oil states, and to say, no, we're not going to back off the RVO. No, that's going to hurt agriculture. And by the way, it's going to create more climate change. You need us. You need agriculture. You need more biofuels. You need to fight. And we got to remember, you know, we got to push our guys to fight, and we got to push them to fight against the oil guys. This is an ag versus oil war. I said that 10 years ago, and I'll say it again today. Agriculture and oil both need the gas tank to be successful long term. Mm-hmm. Whoever gets it, it's going to have a good future. Whoever doesn't, it's going to have a bad future. So we have to fight the battle, get the oil guys to back down, and we're fighting that battle. But ag states got to continue to fight the war. It's a war.
You know, the rhetoric from big oil and the refiners seems to have calmed down a little bit with the Biden administration. It's almost like they realized that if they're going to extend their future, they're going to have to include biofuels and lower carbon fuels, right?
Well, yeah, but they are working. I can't tell you how hard they're pushing right now in Washington the last 3 weeks.
Okay.
RIN price and everything else. I mean, they are working hard right now to turn back the RVOs, hurt agriculture, and help themselves. I mean, they're all over it. So we got to fight back.
Yeah. The easy answer to those RIN prices is to blend more biofuel, isn't it?
Absolutely. That's all they have to do, which they could have done a decade ago. They could have done it 5 years ago. They could have made small investments to blend more E15, and they will not do it because they want to keep the market share tight. They want to keep their prices high.
Yeah.
So it's a market share play. It's all market share.
Yeah, they could have done it.
Battle for the gas tank. Yep.
Yeah, battle for the gas tank. They could have done it 10 years ago, 5 years ago, last week. But most importantly is they could start doing it today, and that would bring that RIN price down, right?
Right. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And there's a little bit of testing going on by some of them because they're, in case they can't get the Biden administration to move, which we're of course trying to make sure they don't move. If they can't get them to move, then they will have to lend more E15, which of course helps agriculture. We're not going to get a derecho in Iowa every year. And we got a derecho, or corn prices would be, probably $1.50 to $2 a bushel lower or more, maybe $2.50 a bushel lower. You're not going to derecho in Iowa every year, maybe every 150. So we're going to go back to oversupplied commodities. We need to get more of the gas tank. We need to move to E15 to keep agriculture successful and to clean up the environment and to lower climate change and to, to use less oil, which is good for the planet and good for everybody.
That's a great spot to end. Jeff Broin, poet, thank you so much for making time for AgriTalk.
Anytime, Chip. Thank you.
You bet. We'll be back with more AgriTalk in a moment.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Dallaro Complete. Keep your operation moving forward with Dallaro Complete from Bayer.
To produce higher yields and greater value at harvest, timing is everything. Full Scale from Helena helps soybeans reach their full potential with breakthrough foliar nutrition and reproduction. Full Scale delivers beneficial plant extracts and micronutrients with the added efficiency of ENC formulation technology. It gives your soybeans every opportunity to grow strong returns this season. Contact your local ag retailer or Helena representative to learn more about Full Scale. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration status before use.
Time for Markets Now with the experts from Pro Farmer.
Joining us now, Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady. Beach. This bean oil market pulling beans to the downside again, isn't it?
Absolutely. Just hemorrhaging here. A breakaway to the downside in a big way in soy oil. Now, keep in mind, there's expanded limits across the soy complex today after the limit down move in soy oil yesterday. So 550 points in soy oil, $45 in meal, and $1.50 in soybeans. So, the potential's there for even more volatility as we move forward if we do hit sell stops and extend these losses here that we're seeing in mid-morning.
Wow. Okay. We'll watch for that. Pressure on corn, pressure on wheat. What's going on?
Well, corn, I think it's weather, and the forecasts are that we're going to see a significant cool down in temperatures from some of the extreme heat that we've had here recently. And then there's some rains that are starting to move in and expected to continue over the next 10 days or so. So that's kind of what we're looking at from a pressure perspective there on corn. The wheat market is following corn and soybeans lower in the winter wheat markets. The spring wheat market, not expected to get much precip up in the northern plains, and we're seeing a mixed tone here mid-morning.
All right. Feeder cattle higher on the lower corn, but live cattle and lean hogs still under pressure.
Well, the hog market, it has expanded limits today as well and trading sharply lower in the front end of that market, but off the lows and not expanding on those expanded limits there. Live cattle are actually pretty quiet so far this morning.
Gotcha. Thank you, Brian. That's Pro Farmer editor Brian Grady on Markets Now.
For a farmer, every day is different, and every season tells its own story. Make this the year you do it your way. Coron Metra is a foliar fertilizer that lets you decide when the time is right for nutrition. Metra gives you flexibility. It gives your tank efficiency. And Metra gives your crop more than just nitrogen. Coron Metra, the next evolution in crop nutrition. Always read and follow label instructions and check registration before use.
Opinions expressed on AgriTalk do not necessarily reflect the views of Farm Journal Broadcasting, affiliate stations, or sponsors. AgriTalk is brought to you by AgriWeb, the digital ranch management solution that puts your whole operation right at your fingertips. Get your first month free by visiting agriweb.com. That's AgriWeb with two B's / Drovers today.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Thank you so much for joining us on this Thursday morning. Now, this is one of my favorite topics, development of markets, development of demand for the products that U.S. farmers, dairies, ranchers produce. And frankly, DMI is one of the best at working with the private sector to generate that new demand. Amy Wagner is the Executive VP for Global Innovation Partnerships at Dairy Management, Inc., and she joins us right now. Amy, welcome to AgriTalk.
Chip, thanks so much for having me.
Excellent. Glad that you're here. You know, one of the strongest impressions made on me about DMI's work in the past happened at the Milk Business Conference out in Vegas when the president of Domino's was there to talk about the partnership with DMI and the development of new products to carry more cheese. DMI has such a strong history of working with food service to develop more demand for cheese here in the U.S., and that partnership with Domino's is just one example, right, Amy?
That's right. You're right, Chip. So we've been working for over a decade with different food service, large food service organizations in the U.S. You know, you mentioned Domino's. We've also partnered with Pizza Hut and Taco Bell, and of course, McDonald's, really to do exactly what you're saying, which is drive U.S. demand.
Yeah.
And we have built, you know, partnerships alone, I think over 2 billion pounds of fluid milk equivalents have grown as a result of the efforts with those partners. So it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. And there's room to grow more in the domestic market, isn't there?
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is, you know, people continue to love pizza. They continue to love a lot of things, dairy. You know, most recently we partnered with Taco Bell, adding dairy mm-hmm. to beverages. So they've launched a couple new items this year that include dairy as part of a beverage. So as part of a frozen beverage. So there are still lots of ways to grow in the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I'm watching the development of the Asian market for U.S. dairy products. It's very impressive. And the international growth that we're seeing with demand for U.S. dairy products is impressive. But are there opportunities like what you're talking about domestically with the industry partnerships? Are there opportunities for that on an international basis too, Amy?
Yeah, not only are there opportunities, but we are actively pursuing those opportunities. You know, in about 2017, we began partnering with the Yum organization, who in the U.S., you probably are aware, overseas, Pizza Hut, Taco Bell, KFC, and they have a huge global footprint. They actually have more stores outside the United States than in the United States. And so we began partnering with them with Pizza Hut in Asia and KFC in Latin America. And since then, we've begun partnering with Domino's in Japan. And then most recently, we have just gotten approval for an agreement with Domino's in the Middle East. So yes, this model that has worked really well in the U.S. Is also working very well to drive U.S. dairy exports.
You know, I'll admit, I don't think of Japan or the Middle East when I think of Domino's, Amy. But but obviously they must be developing a taste for that kind of food.
Yeah, Chip, that's funny. I think you're right. I think most Americans don't think of it. We think of, there's nothing more American than Domino's. But I think what your listeners may not know is that actually Domino's is the number one pizza company in the world. They have 17,000 stores worldwide, but 11,000 are located in their 90-plus international market. So they operate in 90 other markets outside the United States. And so, and about half their global $14 billion worth of sales are outside the U.S. So, and Japan is actually quite a great market for them. You know, again, I don't think most Americans associate cheese and the Japanese culture. And the reality is, you know, the Japanese obviously eat far less cheese than Americans do, but it's growing there. They like cheese, they love cheese, they love, and they love pizza. And probably the best way I can demonstrate that or explain it would really be to talk about a product that they developed that then, through our Checkoff partnership, we helped them create more demand for. And it is called the New Yorker 1 kilogram pizza. And for, you know, again, for most Americans, we don't think in the metric system, but 1 kilogram is 2.2 pounds of cheese. So that's a lot of cheese, Chad.
Yeah.
And that's roughly about three times as much as on their regular large size pizza. And so through the efforts of our partnership, we help them create more demand for them, you know, help them with their marketing and marketing funding so that more people would try that pizza and eat that pizza. And by the way, 100% of that pizza is U.S. sourced mozzarella cheese. So it's pretty amazing. It's pretty delicious. We actually, you know, as part of our partnership agreements, our partners come to the U.S. and report out to our board of directors annually. And they came in February of 2020, right before COVID set in, and they sampled this delicious pizza for our board. And it's pretty amazing. It is, has basically two ingredients. It is dough, and it is 2.2 pounds of cheese on top of it. And I think what was most surprising
sauce?
Is that it is, I know, it's delicious, and it is served with, you're going to love this, it's served with your choice of a packet of either maple syrup or dried seaweed. So that's where, and I think, you know, that's one of the things we've learned from working internationally, that while some things are universal, people love pizza, there are definitely, you know, different tastes and palates that you need to cater to. Yeah. But that pizza has done very, very well there. And again, I'm proud to say uses 100% U.S. cheese.
Yeah, and 2.2 pounds of it per pie. That's
a ton. Yeah, exactly.
That's a big one. You know, Amy, when current USDA Secretary Vilsack was with the U.S. Dairy Export Council until recently, he reminded us here on AgriTalk many, many times that only 4 or 5% of the demand base for the products that U.S. producers produces here in the United States, which means 95-96% of the demand is outside of the U.S. We can't ignore the development of these international markets.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, not only are the populations outside the U.S., the population growth rate is, you know, is faster outside the United States. And honestly, incomes are rising. And with that tends to come appetites for Western foods. So pizza, burgers, chicken, people in many foreign markets really enjoy those foods. And it's really, you know, our work is very focused on making sure that when they eat those foods, first of all, they eat them more frequently. And secondly, that they, that U.S. dairy is part of that. So, and wow. I'm actually glad, Chip, that you mentioned USDAC, you know, again, for your listeners to kind of understand, USDAC is a sister organization of DMI. You know, it was founded by farmers back in 1995, and it is primarily funded by Checkoff, although also funded through member dues and U.S. government funding. But my point being is that we really work, the work we do at DMI direct with partnerships, we really do in tandem with USDAC. They do so much foundational work. They really figure out where the markets are that we should go, and they directed us. I mean, we, on the DMI side, we really had the relationship with these companies like Domino's and Pizza Hut, but they directed us on which markets made most sense to enter based on a whole host of criteria like the regulatory environment, et cetera. So it's really a hand-in-glove effort when we work with them.
Gotcha. We've got just a couple of minutes left here, Amy, but I do have to ask, if we're putting maple syrup on pizzas in Japan, what are they doing in the Middle East?
Oh my gosh. Well, that, you know, that partnership is just getting started. So we just got approval from our board earlier this year, and we just got approval from the USDA about a month ago. So we're just getting started. But they also, you know, they also love cheese, and they really love love cheese there. But I'm sure there will be other ingredients that we will be focusing on there as well. They also do a version of that kilogram pizza there, and we'll be helping to support it. But, you know, the way we look at the opportunity there, though, is while they love cheese, there's just so much more upside. I mean, if I could leave you with one more stat, I would say, consider that the average American eats about 37 pounds of cheese a year. The average Saudi Arabian eats about 14. So they like it, but they have a whole lot more upside. So our goal is really to work with our partner there and to just drive more demand for pizza. Because, again, with that comes growth of U.S. cheese.
Who is the partner there in Saudi Arabia?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked that. The partner there is actually an organization called Alamar Foods. And they are what is called a master franchisee. So that is very common in international markets, where you have these organizations who, you know, unlike in the U.S., where you have many more like mom and pop franchisees that we think of, maybe own one or two or even 10 stores, there are master franchisees who own really or sub-franchisee out hundreds of stores. Yeah. And so they have more capabilities to do their own marketing and product development.
Yeah.
They follow the guidelines of Domino's. But they also have oversight to those stores and the operations.
Gotcha.
So really great to partner with them.
We're out of time, but this is a fascinating story to me. We need to continue to stay up on what's going on with the development of these Asian markets. Thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it a lot.
Chip, I would love to anytime. Thank you so much.
Excellent. That's Amy Wagner, Executive Vice President of Global Innovation Partnerships for DMI. We'll be back with more AgriTalk in a moment.
AgriTalk is brought to you by Indigo's Carbon Farming Connection, a free virtual event on June 23rd, where industry-leading experts and farmers will discuss the state of agricultural carbon markets. Learn more at indigoag.com/carbonfarming.
Welcome back to AgriTalk. I'm your host, Chip Flory. Traceability in the animal agriculture. You know, consumers want it, health animal health providers want it, producers want it, and there's a new product out there that might be giving us a big step forward. We've got Melissa Brandau with us. She is with Herd Dog. Melissa, welcome to AgriTalk. How are you?
Hi, I'm great, Chip. Thank you. Thank you. Great to hear from you.
You bet. Glad that you're here. You know, like I said, traceability is something that the entire industry is looking for. The problem was making it easy for that data to stick with the animal throughout its life. Is that what Herd Dog is attempting to do?
Yes, it really is. It's not just been that it's been difficult to attach data to the animal, but it's also the focus of making sure that value continues for the cow-calf operator in going into traceability, right? So there hasn't been a lot of ability to really enable value for the cow-calf operators through the process. So we do two things. One is we attach data to the animal that can stay with the animal throughout its life stage and move from one venue to the other through the supply chain. And then the other is we add value to the cow-calf operator with that data to ensure that they can make more money from every animal they raise.
Okay. Is that where the inspiration for this came from the cow-calf side, or was it further down the chain, or at, you know, even at the consumer level?
Well, it was both. I mean, I think that there has been sort of winds of change happening in the industry, both from the standpoint of cow-calf operators making less money off of their animals, and some of that value being shifted towards processing. But also consumers' awareness due to COVID has really changed everything. I think it has been a game changer for the industry. Consumers want to know where their meat is coming from, and to be able to deliver that information to them more quickly, more succinctly, and more locally, I think is really an exciting adventure. And that's really what we're all about.
Well, and for the consumer, if I'm seeing the description of the product right, Melissa, for the consumer, the information is available real time.
Right. It's available on that very specific piece of meat that they want to purchase in the grocery store.
Yeah.
So being able to provide them kind of the insight into the producer, maybe some of the provenance on the animal itself, you know, where they lived, where they were raised, what kind of breed. Just bringing the consumer into the discussion really, we feel, will help traceability be more supported throughout the industry. I know it's a hot button. It's definitely a hot button, but we feel that if we do it right, then everybody wins. Yeah. And that's really our focus, is making sure that we do it right, adding value for the cow-calf operators and adding value for the consumers.
That's going to be interesting the first time a consumer goes to the meat case and scans that QR code and gets all that information, Melissa. It's going to be interesting what their reaction is to that.
And we'll be doing that right here in Wyoming. We're very excited about it. So over the next couple of months, we'll be getting to that point. And that is a pivotal moment, I think, for all of us.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, don't let that moment get away without a video rolling on that. That's for sure. Okay. I know that you've helped develop the system, but what have you learned about herd dog once it was tagged on a real animal?
You know, we have an internal joke about the fact that once you put a device like this on a cow, it's like sending that cow to Mars. So the reality is, you know, you have to be really good at the technology, make sure that it works, because you're not necessarily going to be able to get it back or be able to interface with that animal again for months. So I think we really appreciate how much goes into a very simple little ear tag device that is being installed on an animal. And then on the flip side of that, I would say the power of being able to know that you're getting data off of animals that could be, you know, 2 acres away in real time is just an extraordinary experience for everybody. And with Bluetooth 5, with our new tags, long-range capabilities are unequaled in the industry. And and yet, you can also get that information direct to your mobile phone. So those are really the two key things. We really have now a product that reads at long distances and a product that reads directly to your phone. So those are awesome opportunities for cow-calf operators and the industry in general.
Yeah, well, and brand building, too. You said it, Melissa, at the start. We're talking about the changes that consumers have gone through during through the pandemic. They are looking for that connection to the provider of their food, and this is a way for that even the cow-calf producer to build a brand that makes its way into the meat case, right?
That's right. And in particular, we see that in Wyoming where – the regulation is enabling producers to sell direct to consumers in ways that has never, in recent years has not happened. And, you know, more power to them. I think that really brings everybody together to the table, literally, in a very exciting way, in a new way. So really leveraging technology and data to enable better consuming, more informed consumers, happier cow-calf operators, because they know what their constituents want. So it's very, very exciting times.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so it's in prototype development in Wyoming. What's the timeline on this product look like, Melissa?
So the product is available on our website. You can go online and buy a starter kit. We put it into very small packaging to enable any size producer to be able to buy our product. What we're really focusing on in Wyoming is this traceability.
Okay.
So from cow-calf operator into the grocery store. So that part of it is happening now. We'll be able to report back and sort of give you the final and end point look of things in about 2 months.
Excellent. Excellent. Melissa, good luck with Herd Dog. Appreciate your time.
Thank you, Chip. Good day.
That is Melissa Brandow from Herd Dog. Come back this afternoon. We're going to be talking about what's going on in the dairy markets with Alyssa Badger from High Ground Dairy. Tomorrow morning, free-for-all, Wiesmeyer, Haney, and Mark Rucker.